failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies.
Hello, my friends. Welcome to this edition of Century of Lies. I'm glad you could be with us. We've got another busy program today. I'm bringing back a segment that we recorded on 420 at the Normal Conference out in San Francisco. We have segments from many of our regular reporters, and we're also going to introduce for the first time the first recipient of the Tinfoil Hat Award. So please stay tuned for that a little bit later. But right now, let's time travel back to San Francisco and 420.
Our next speaker is going to be James Woodford. He holds a B.S. and Ph.D. in chemistry. He's performed chemical analysis for Scotland Yard, the U.S. Army. He actually holds U.S. patents on many of the odors for controlled substances. And the law enforcement uses those to train drug dogs to identify drugs. And then he goes to court and explains why the dogs actually shouldn't be able to identify these drugs at all based on these odors. So I bring to the mic Jim Woodford.
Well, I brought with me a news article, April 1st, 2006. Spokane District halts use of dogs for drug searches. There's a lawsuit going on up there. And one of the reasons is they brought the dogs in to school, and they found that dogs were wrong about 85% of the time they indicated something was amiss during searches. And I'm going to try to explain to you why the dogs miss about 85% of the times, and a lot of them are worse. And it all has a chemical basis. Paul just mentioned about the cocaine odor patent. I discovered some years ago that dogs don't smell drugs, the drugs themselves. They smell odors that emit from drugs. The odor that emits from cocaine, for example, is methylbenzoate. And that's the, my patent has been used by the government for U.S. Customs and the government for over 20 years. Starting there with the methylbenzoate and bring it on up to ecstasy. Talk about the chemistry of what the dogs are doing or should be doing but aren't doing. And why it is that our dog use industry is perverted, if you look at it on a scientific basis. Something that I think is a constitutional question, and it goes back to something I learned back in 1982 in a case that came. It's a federal appellate decision called United States versus Beal. And in that's when dog use really started to take off, 1982, with this Beal case. In the Beal case, there were all the experts from the government came in and gave glowing recommendations for dogs. Oh, dogs are fabulous. They can do this. They can do that. And the court allowed the dog use. But it's very interesting. I pulled up that case, and I wanted to read a little bit from it. Because this sets up my topic here about the constitutional part. In the Beal case, that paraphrasing from the dicta or the language from the decision, drug-detecting canine use is distinguishable from all other search activities because the only information gleaned from the canine's examination is whether contraband is present. They had experts coming in and said, don't worry, these dogs only alert to illegal substances. So you don't have to worry about it. So it's not like other searches where you come up with something legal. But the court put this beautiful footnote in there that is the cornerstone to my talk today. Footnote number 14 states, our decision is expressly premised on this concept of canine reliability that dogs only alert to illegal substances, i.e. contraband. And the court noted, should this premise that dogs only alert to illegal substances prove inaccurate, the use of dogs would not be condoned. This is 1982. Now we go all the way up to the Caballes decision, a recent Supreme Court decision that has the same premise. This premise has been carried for 24 years, in footnotes, to present day. Dogs only alert to illegal substances. Well, I'm going to tell you what dogs alert to. For cocaine, dogs don't alert to cocaine. They alert to methylbenzoate. It's a perfectly legal substance. It's found in Jovan perfume. It's found in our foodstuffs. It's found in the garbage, from fermenting orange peels. It's not an illegal substance. The best trained dogs are imprinted using Pavlov's method, where you take methylbenzoate, among other things, distractors, but you train the dog using food reward to this chemical odor. It's called a single molecule odor. A single molecule odor is like ammonia or chlorine. It's just one thing. If I let go some ammonia right here, single molecules travel back to the end of the room, there's still single molecules of ammonia. Those little single molecules go into a dog's nose or human's nose, bind to the receptor in a lock and key fashion. That's what gives the smell. For cocaine, it's methylbenzoate. It turns out that dogs can be imprinted up to about 5 different odors, and then they start getting confused. It can be bomb odors, drug odors. It can be arson residues or cadavers, for example. Cadavers give off a single thing called cadaverine. So dogs are single molecule odor detectors. Methylbenzoate is a single molecule from cocaine. In the course of my work, the government researchers have confirmed my patented material is, in fact, the odor that dogs alert to from cocaine, and it's used as a standard in the dog training industry, has been for many years. Dogs don't smell methamphetamine. They smell benzaldehyde. It's a breakdown product that gets into the air. Turns out benzaldehyde is a perfectly legal substance. Foodstuffs, flavoring agents. So dogs are usually trained on up to five things. And they usually say it's cocaine, methamphetamine, heroin, ecstasy, or sometimes PCP, but now it's ecstasy, and marijuana. So there are 5 different things that dogs are said to be trained to. Dogs don't smell heroin. They smell acetic acid, single molecule that's given off by heroin. Dogs don't smell ecstasy. They smell piperonal, another completely legal substance. But now, I'm getting to my constitutional thing. You have the court saying dogs in Beal, dogs only detect illegal substances. My research and government researchers now have proved conclusively that dogs do not alert to illegal substances. They alert to legal substances. So what do we think about this court saying, and should this premise that dogs only alert to illegal substances prove inaccurate, the use of dogs would not be condoned? That's what the federal courts have said. With government experts, me along with them, we can prove conclusively that they don't. I mean, that's where we are with it. Here, 24 years later, all drug dogs are said to be able to do 5 things. One of them is marijuana. And in my research, actually this is research from the government marijuana farm, the latest, a list of the 68 single molecule ingredients that these are the odor principles of marijuana. 68 different ingredients. Which one would you pick to say is marijuana? It turns out that all of those ingredients are also in many other things. There is no single molecule odor for marijuana that anybody's come up with to know how to imprint dogs. And if you trace the history of dog training back to forever, there's always been a problem with the marijuana. The dogs aren't very good, and they don't care about marijuana. And I went through, when I had my license to carry marijuana all over the world, and I had a bag, and I went to the went through a pack of 25 highly trained drug dogs. None of them could give a tickety-boo about anything. Nobody showed any interest at all. Recently up in Seattle, somebody went through the airport, a medical marijuana user, goes through, dog goes right by the dog, and he goes back. This was in the paper. He goes back and says, excuse me, this drug dog didn't alert, but I'm carrying marijuana. Why? And the more I look into this, and I realize, and if you read the newspaper carefully, basically what's going on is you'll have marijuana arrests and marijuana busts, and they'll find some marijuana. The police will find it because they got a tip there's some there, or they accidentally come upon it, or it's somehow they find it, and they just happen to have a dog with them. And so they say, they give the dog credit as if the dog found it. And then they go to court and say, well, dog found the marijuana. They're not, it's theater. These dogs, first of all, nobody's come up with a way to, suppose you wanted to train a dog. Say you people have dogs. There's a dog here. I saw a dog walking around right here. Suppose we get the dog and we want to train the dog to smell marijuana. What would you do? What is marijuana? It's a multi-ordinate term. How many varieties? How many odors of marijuana can you think of? What do you do? Where do you get them? It's the odor of marijuana is very, very much related to geographic location and variety. I mean, the marijuana on the East Coast does not smell like the marijuana, even to humans, like the marijuana on the West Coast. Mexican marijuana doesn't smell like anything there. Hydro from Florida, bubble gum, sweet sativa, chocolate, shoe polish, hay, mown grass. What do you do? Well, let me just show you some odor boxes. These are training boxes. Look at this video. Here they got to train this dog. And look at these boxes they're using. They're using wooden boxes in training. Now, if you go back and look at science of how you train a dog, you never use a wooden box. You have to use a galvanized steel box. It's called little sniffers to put the training aids in. But now they've gone to wooden boxes. Look at this guy. He puts his foot up there on top of the thing, showing the dog what to do. But these boxes are used over and over again. 20 years ago, they weren't using wooden boxes. The dogs were being imprinted. Nowadays, they're not imprinted. They're being trained on these odor boxes made of wood, and then they're just using play conditioning to reinforce that with a tennis ball. Here's an odor box for marijuana. You see, it's made of wood. There's the guy showing you that he takes a baggie of marijuana. Did you take a look at that bag? What's in that baggie? So the question is, what's in that baggie? Where do they get it? What marijuana? What is, is that the standard? That means that the dog, anytime ever in his life he encounters marijuana, is going to be like that? You can imprint dogs for cocaine, methamphetamine. They do a pretty good job on that. If you imprint them. If you don't imprint them, the dog's really no good. They get about an 85% fail rate, or they give an indication about 85% of the time. The idea that the dogs detect marijuana has no scientific basis. Nobody's figured out how to do it. It hasn't been done. Now, the thing is, people know about times when dogs find marijuana. Sometimes they actually find it. And the way they find it is not because it's marijuana. It's because it's green vegetable matter. It turns out if you take any green vegetable matter and you put it in a baggie, it respires, it breathes. It breathes out carbonic acid, a single molecule. Carbonic acid happens to be an ingredient in dog urine. So any dog, you don't have to train a dog at all. You put vegetables in a plastic bag, the dog's going to be interested in it. This is how customs dogs work. So when people are going through airports, the custom dogs, the vegetable dogs, can actually find marijuana. but it's not because it's marijuana, and it's not because the dog is smelling something that's illegal. But when the dog, if somebody's coming through customs and you see the dog alerting, you say, oh, the dog was trained to detect marijuana. That's theater. The dog wasn't. It's the dog can't tell you what it's interested in, can't talk. It's the handler that's the one that's saying what the dog did. The handler gives the dog all the credit. Oh, well, from the same article in Spokane, they brought the dogs in to look for illegal prescription or over-the-counter drugs, alcohol, and tobacco. They're not trained on any of that stuff. But you as a person reading the newspaper, you think the dogs are just, these dogs, you know, the dog found my Sudafed. You know, it's absurd. So the dogs aren't doing a very good job, and the science is perverted. If you're going to buy a dog, you want to buy that dog as a drug dog, it'd be great. Oh, yeah, look at him. He did it. And they give him the ball. There's his reward for doing it. Here's the same guy, same facility, different dog, same box, different dog. How much drug residue do you think is built up in that wooden box over the years they've been training these dogs? It's the same box over and over again. It's just ridiculous. So the science of dogs at the time of Beale was pretty good. They used metal boxes. They imprinted the dogs by the Pavlovian food reward method. You could give the dog to any handler, the thing would work. Nowadays, the science has completely fallen. The bottom has fallen out. The dogs aren't even imprinted anymore. The dogs are play dogs with play reward that can't tell you that, actually, I didn't find the drug. It was just really an old burger, a piece of burger. But the cop says, no, drugs. I found the drug. Here are the drugs. Dog did it. Well, that's the basic thing. Here's the play reward video. They spent a lot of time getting the dog really going for this tennis ball. That dog knows when the handler starts to go like this for a tennis ball, dog alerts. It's amazing. You don't have to have any drugs or anything. Be in an empty room. Just go for the tennis ball, dog alerts. There's a lot of the handlers are just making this up. They're orchestrating it, giving the dogs credit when the dogs are doing nothing. And it's a sick situation.
That was Dr. James Woodford speaking, and you are listening to Century of Lies on the Drug Truth Network. As I say 1,000 times, there's no truth, justice, logic, or scientific fact involved. If a cop tells you anything different, if his lips are moving, he's lying. The problem with the dogs is that they don't use their lips. Next up, Drug Truth Network reporter Terry Nelson, who has 32 years' experience serving our nation as a customs and border official.
Just say cheese. This timeless, family-friendly saying has taken on a new meaning in urban schools in North Texas. Defined by contemporary urban lingo, cheese is a mixture of heroin and crushed Tylenol PM. Meant to be snorted, 1/10 of a gram costs $2. Police are calling the cheese mixture starter heroin. In the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, just say cheese to a drug dealer and it could be fatal. This deadly powdered mix is apparently becoming popular with middle and high school kids. Linked to the latest trend is the recent death of a young man reported in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram on May 19th. This young man died of an apparent overdose of the drug. The truth of the issue is that many more may die from this drug because of the way kids obtain it. For first-time users, most drugs are obtained from older teens. The secret progresses to members of drug gangs and street drug dealers. The sellers, part of the long distribution channel, may or may not have cut the product themselves. To those of you who are not familiar with heroin or other addicted drugs, one does not have to die just because they become addicted to a drug. Recovering addicts agree that while it is certainly not recommended, one can maintain a heroin habit for many years, providing the quality and quantity is the same, purity. The problem comes when a user accustomed to a street shot of, say, 8% heroin, which is what cheese is reported to contain, one day scores an 8-plus heroin-rich hit from a known or unknown source. Snorters shoot up the heroin, which is substantially more than 8%, and the risk could possibly be fatal. Qualified medical help is essential in combating the effects of an overdose. The best way to survive that occurrence is to get to a hospital emergency room as quick as possible and be prepared to be honest with the doctors. Provide the facts and the chances of survival dramatically improve. Sounds simple, right? Sadly, kids experimenting with drugs may die because their friends are afraid to take them to an emergency room in fear of being arrested for participating in an illegal activity. This is tragic and does not need to happen. The annual number of deaths in the United States each year attributed to heroin overdoses is approximately 3,000. These 3,000 people did not have to die. One of the reasons they are dead is that there is no quality control in the distribution network of cartels, drug gangs, and street dealers. Chances are that these people would still be alive if they could have purchased a drug from a reliable, licensed source. I am a retired law enforcement officer with more than 30 years' experience in the war on drugs, and I no longer believe that we have a chance of winning. Drugs are cheaper today and of much higher quality than they were in 1974 when I started police work. If we have any hope of winning the fight against drug cartels, we must legalize the drugs, take the criminal gangs out of the distribution network. Let the state regulate, distribute, and tax the drugs that you choose to purchase instead of criminal drug gangs. Legalizing drugs will also have another effect. Approximately 80% of the crime associated with illegal drugs occurs in the distribution chain. Thus, we could reduce crime by a large percentage by legalizing all drugs. Major crimes such as rape and murder have fallen in the past 10 years, but drug-related crimes have increased. In 2004, there were over 1.5 million drug arrests in the United States. This number increases annually and shows no sign of dropping. These figures indicate that we have lost the drug war and need to change the rules and end the game. I believe that it is time to treat drug use as a social issue and not a criminal one. This is Terry Nelson on behalf of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, at www.leap.cc, signing off.
This is Phil Smith of the Drug War Chronicle with this week's Corrupt Cop Stories. We usually spend a lot of time down on the Mexican border or in some podunk Alabama or Mississippi department, but this week we're going to the Big Apple. We've got two corruption stories out of New York City this week. In the first one, an NYPD officer was indicted May 18th on charges she conspired to rip off cocaine from stash houses in Manhattan, federal prosecutors announced. Officer Cursix de la Cruz faces up to life in prison for conspiracy to distribute cocaine and conspiracy to commit robbery. Two others, including her uncle, are also charged in a series of robberies where de la Cruz pointed out potential targets to her co-conspirators. The officer became involved in the scheme after borrowing money from her uncle, who asked her if she knew anyone who could help rob drug dealers. De la Cruz allegedly put her uncle in contact with a dealer who knew where the dope houses were, and the ripoff crew hit a house last July and made off with 7 kilos of coke. But a snitch heard about that one. The uncle went down, and he in turn snitched out De La Cruz. In our second New York City case, two members of the New York Air National Guard pleaded guilty in federal court in Manhattan last Friday to conspiring to distribute ecstasy. They admitted to using a U.S. Air Force jet to fly from New York to Germany to pick up 300,000 hits of the popular club drug. Captain Franklin Rodriguez, age 36, and Master Sergeant John Fong, age 37, flew an official mission to the Republic of Georgia in April 2005, then detoured to Germany to pick up the stash, but were arrested upon landing at Stewart Air National Guard base near Newburgh. As part of his plea agreement, Rodriguez forfeited $726,000 in cash found in a safe in his apartment, along with a 2001 BMW and $49,000 he had just put down on a property in Mount Vernon. Both men face up to 20 years in prison. It's just another week of drug war corruption, and as always, there's more. Check it out online at www.stopthedrugwar.org.
In England, earlier this week, an independent panel issued a report supporting the establishment of drug consumption rooms. The UK's Home Office Ministry rejected the proposal. A parliamentary committee had previously endorsed safe consumption rooms in 2002. The Home Office rejected the idea then as well, bowing to pressure from groups opposed to harm reduction programs. Surprisingly, this time, the Tories, England's Conservative Party, are embracing the idea. Their shadow Home Secretary, Edward Garner, told the Daily Telegraph that, quote, "We do not rule out these recommendations. If this is to take place in a controlled environment and is to be used as a stepping stone to actually getting people off drugs, we will look at this carefully," end quote. What they will find is that these facilities are indeed effective and helpful at many levels. Safe consumption rooms have been used successfully in several countries, including Canada and Australia, as well as European nations like Germany and Switzerland. Research has shown that these facilities do not lead to crime or drug dealing in the neighborhoods in which they're located, nor do they create other nuisances, nor do they promote drug use. To the contrary, drug consumption rooms reduce public nuisances and promote public health. They provide an opportunity for outreach to drug addicts to get them needed medical and psychological care, eventually getting them into treatment. The report was funded by the UK charity, the Joseph Rowntree Foundation. A copy is available through their website as well as through commonsensedrugpolicy.org. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org.
Every week we produce the official government truth because agents of the government refuse to come on our program for love or money. Every once in a while, Winston gets it right, so listen up.
So you tuned in again. What are you doing? You thinking about writing your congressman? Attending a normal meeting? Marching on Washington? Of course not. Here's the problem. To speak up is to speak out, and to let everyone you know what you do. And is it really any of their business? And why snitch yourself out to the authorities? Write your congressman? Talk to local police? Are you kidding me? Think of the risk. Besides, you can't win. Let me tell you a secret. If I bought a pack of stationery and wrote each of you a letter, when I was done, I would still have paper and envelopes left over. You're not the majority. Look, if you just lay low, you'll be okay. You haven't gotten this far by standing up and standing out. You've done it by blending in. So be smart. Turn off the radio and go live your life. If you lay low and stay out of trouble, you'll be just fine. This has been Winston Francis with the official Government Truth.
So you've got a choice to be sheeple or people. It's really up to you. And insofar as that pack of stationery with 50 million potential listeners, I think he'd run out of paper pretty quick. And with that thought in mind, I want to welcome the newest, the 57th affiliate to the Drug Truth Network, WLFR, in Pomona, New Jersey. Welcome, my friends. In recognition of outstanding achievements in the field of outstanding, the Drug Truth Network is proud to present the Tin Foil Hat Award. Notable achievements of our first recipient. The day she was selected to be the administrator of the DEA in response to a question about medical marijuana and the report of the U.S. Institute of Medicine, she proclaimed, quote, "I don't read the peripheral reports." Last week, she told the Houston Chronicle that when she took on the job of administrator, quote, "I made money the number one priority. The amount of money the DEA seized each year has more than quadrupled to $1.9 billion last year, making the DEA the rare federal agency that nearly pays for itself," she joked. She crows about taking down the godfather of marijuana seeds, Canada's Mark Emery, yet the entity who invented these seeds and is the true father of the seed industry is widely known to be someone much higher than Mr. Emery. For these and at least 1.6 million other reasons, the number of U.S. citizens arrested each year for bags of plant products, the Drug Truth Network hereby awards its first ever Tin Foil Hat Award to Karen P. Tandy. I'll be mailing the award to her home in Avondale, Virginia. Do you think she'll frame it? I guess that's it for today. Please keep in mind we have been duped. The outlaws run both sides of this drug war equation. Please do your part to help end this madness. Visit our website, endprohibition.org. Prohibido istak evilesco.
For the Drug Truth Network, this is Dean Becker asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Our engineer, Philip Duffy.